Good morning, everybody. Thank you guys very, very much. Open your Bibles to Mark chapter 4. So, we leave the series of the wonderful hard works of love. And I have loved it. And Adam, you're sitting there, but I want to thank you and every teacher in that series. It was a profound series, and we thank you so, so much. She was in first service. She's not here, but I just want to thank Louise. I haven't had her preach much. I just didn't know. She teaches everywhere, and she's in Sunday school classes everywhere. She taught in that series, and then last week I had to be up at the men's retreat, and I didn't know I was going to be there, and she taught. Oh, I knew I was going to be there. I just didn't know I was going to be there on Sunday. She just taught in a moment's notice on trust, and she just blesses us so for so long. She's just protected and loved this body. So I'm just stunned by my sister. And you'll see her again in this next series, Encountering Jesus. 18 weeks, where we are going to take people who do not normally, well, some of them normally do, but some you've not heard from the pulpit. Where else in town in a series would you have Marcia Kuiper preach as in the series and Mark Williams? You just don't have it. You can't name five churches where that's going to happen. I'm so uber excited. I'm excited for you. What is about to happen for you in this series? I want to show you something I was thinking about of how you can approach each week. As we open the Gospels, and our desire is to actually place ourselves into the Scriptures, into the living Scriptures, and encounter ourselves in the scene with Jesus. If His Holy Spirit's in us, and His Word is alive, and Jesus is in us and alive, then that becomes a conduit for me to experience Him in real time. That's normative. That's for us. It's just not words on a page and sometimes the words in red. We get to do that. Our God, we get to see Him. Our favorite person in the universe, we get to see Him in Scripture. And be in the scene. Find ourselves in the scene and just watch. And then let it wash over us and ask, where am I in that picture? So I said, place yourself in the scene amongst the main characters. Ask yourself what the people in this scene need. And how does Jesus choose to meet their needs? By His love. And what does this scene tell you that you need? And what attribute of Jesus is drawing you to trust Him more? And finally, what attribute of Jesus here draws you into worship? I felt it even this morning in myself, being drawn to trust Him more and being drawn to worship. So here's the passage, verse 35 of chapter 4 in Mark. On that day, I can't think of a better message to start the series with, a better passage to ground us into who this Jesus is. And then we will walk in such beauty off it. But I couldn't think of a better starting message than this one. On that day, when evening came, He said to them, "Let us go over to the other side." Leaving the crowd, they took Him along with them in the boat, just as He was, and there were other boats with them. And there arose a fierce gale of wind, and the waves were breaking over the boat so much that the boat was already filling up. And Jesus Himself was in the stern, asleep on the cushion. And they woke Him and said to Him, "Teacher, do you not care that we're perishing?" Stacy and I had the unbelievable privilege of getting, never thought that would happen in my lifetime, and right at the end of my preaching career, I get to go. So you never ever got any benefit from it, but still, it was great. About a year and a half ago, we got to go to the Middle East and got to go to the Sea of Galilee. And while we were there, some people were on this boat. We went out on a boat ride, and these people were there, just strangers from Mackinac, Washington, I believe. That's Bruce and Janet McNichol, and that's Bill and Grace Thrall, and that's Doug and Nadine Houston. Stacy's driving the boat, and I'm taking the picture. I had the privilege. They spontaneously just said, "John, will you read this passage?" And so that is Syria behind me. That's the Sea of Galilee, and that's an old wooden boat that they let you go out on. And on the left side of this picture that I'm looking at is ISIS-controlled part of Syria. And if you were looking in the direction that I'm looking, right in front of me would be Capernaum. And in front of me would be this pretty immediate slope of Mount Hermon. So if that can put some context, we're probably a quarter mile out to sea, not far from where they would have been when this happened. Maybe they were a half mile. Also, there have been artist depictions of this scene. Way back in 1633, the artist Rembrandt did a picture on this. It's called Jesus in the Storm on the Sea of Galilee. This is a profound painting. It's genius. We'll look at it up close in a second. This was done in 1633. It was stolen in 1990 by some guys that dressed up as police officers, and they made this heist, and they've never seen it again. It may or may not be in my garage. But I want, if you would give me the close-up of this now, you'll see, first of all, I want you to see the main line is snapped off already. I want to point out some stuff. First of all, I want to ask you a question. If there's one thing, if there's one teaching that Rembrandt's trying to do in this scene, take a look at it for a second. Is there any insight that you get from this painting of what he's trying to teach us? Just raise your hand. Don't anybody say anything. Don't talk out without raising your hands. Yes, what do you see? Yes. I can't see. It's in the dark. I just see hands. Yeah. Jesus has probably been down in the stern, in the galley. You can't see it, but there he is. By this time, they've awakened him. He's sitting there, and he's perfectly calm. You're exactly right. What else about the proximity? Yes. Everybody is doing something. Everybody's trying to save their lives. What else? What else do you see? Raise your hand. Yes. Ah, that's interesting. It says these guys are trying to save themselves. These guys are starting to go, maybe it's a little late in the game. Such a fascinating. It appears the further away you get from Jesus, the worse things are for you. I love it here. This guy who's at the stern, it's his job. He's been doing a fine job. And at some point, he just, look at the look on his face. Nah. That's not even in the water anymore. He's just listening to Jesus. He's going, if there's any chance of me being saved, it's right here. His hands are still on there just by muscle memory. This whoever this is actually has his hand on Jesus. Rembrandt, this isn't peaceable. Look at him. He's sitting there. He has not stood up to do anything, to make any pronouncements at all. He's just sitting there. He's probably talking. He's just chatting. He's chatting. Hey, you know, by the way, gentlemen, did I mention that thing about the lilies of the field? And these guys are going, ah! This guy grabs him. Peter, by the way, I healed your mom, but how's she doing? And these guys, meanwhile, they're lashed to the mast. So this guy's grabbing him. This guy, I think, is probably the one that Rembrandt thinks is saying, don't you care that we're perishing? This guy right here, I don't know if you can see it, but he's got his hand on his head. He's actually looking at the audience. Rembrandt paints it in such a way, he's looking at the viewer going, can you folks help us? Yeah. Look at these guys. These guys are going, all right, the safest place on this boat is by this mast. This will save us unless the entire boat's going down. These guys, look at them. They're not even fully real anymore. They are part of being trashed by the sea. They can't hear Jesus at all. They can't hear a thing. They're just holding on. And this guy, I love him. He thinks he can actually help by maybe, you know, tweaking the jib a little bit and moving the thing. This is Sam Hill. Sam can do things. See, I can't do anything. I can't be there. What am I going to do? But he's thinking, look at this. Look at the storm. The water is filling up in the boat. I'll just tweak this a little bit. It'll be fine. And then there's me. John Lynch is one of two people. No, you know, the genius of the scene is every one of us. Every one of us. I talked to someone last service in the restroom. He goes, I'm all those people in a crisis. But in a crisis, all of us can find ourselves in this. Down in here, there's one person praying. You can't see him very well, but he's the only, right there, do you see him? He's the only one. You can't see inside here, but there's a guy even inside the galley. Look at this guy. He's throwing up over the side. He's been listening to Jesus, but he's going, just give me a second. But here I am. Here I am. I'm close enough. I'm so close to hearing Jesus, but I'm well aware that there's a storm going on here, and I'm freaked out, and it's causing me to not be able to hear very well right now. Beautiful, beautiful, powerful scene. Horrible scene. Rembrandt, I just love how he's captured it. Mark, if you go ahead and put that next slide up. Man rarely approaches faith with an adequate apprehension of grace. God instead allows us to see our failure and our inability to solve ourselves. And then he undoes us by revealing himself greater than our fears. This new fear frees us from our fears and releases us to risk a life of love in more significant influence than we could ever dream. And grace, our grace is experienced as infinitely more than a hall pass of small religion. It becomes the only means to adequately experience my God. When evening had come, oh, what a day. What a day. Stifling crowds. Everywhere he goes, it's claustrophobic. He has a scuffle with his own brothers they're trying to take him home. They're so afraid for him. He's accused by the scribes of demon possession. Humanity is crushing all around him, shouting his name, begging for healings. The disciples couldn't even get food to him. He's so beaten up. He's so tired. I mean, this is so human of Jesus. When I see this, I get to see this, I forget sometimes, I'm thinking, well, he's fully God, but he's fully human. He got exhausted and drained and dehydrated and physically starving. It's so interesting. The verb that they use, it says, and then they took him. It's the same verb that they use when the angel says to Joseph, take the young child and his mother and flee to Egypt. Take the young child and his mother under your protection and care. This is the same way that it talks about the disciples. They just had to protect him. So they took him along with them in the boat, just as he was. And there were other little boats. This is the boat they were in is called Ploion. It means a larger boat. It's not just a fishing boat. It's has a partially enclosed hull, as Rembrandt tried to depict. And the other boats near them were just little fishing boats. And they would trail away very quickly, and the story wouldn't be about them. So as it says, later on, they set Jesus in the back of the boat, probably in that little underneath hull area, probably partially covered by the stern, and he's on a cushion. Jesus, he's exhausted with the sea lapping against the boat. He falls immediately to sleep, deep, deep sleep. And then off in the distance, there is a sound, a rumble. It's the storm. And they have been at sea for so many occasions that none of them want to turn and look because they know that sound. If they know any sound, they understand the sound of weather. These are fishermen. The Sea of Galilee is 682 feet below the Mediterranean. And when the dark clouds crest Mount Hermon and they come over and start rushing into the valley, it is life-threatening to be on the water. The hot air on the Sea of Galilee from the day it now is pulling the storm down that mountain slope, and it rushes down with sudden, explosive, destructive power. This is so early in the gospel, maybe that's helpful to understand how they see Jesus. He's healed people, but as yet, it's really been water into wine and a few healings, physical healings. But they are fishermen, and they're thinking, there's not much he can do. This is nature now. This is our stuff. Water and foam and sea and wind and rain and course correction. This is us. We're fishermen. We know storms. He's a wonderful man, and I don't know how he does some of those things, and they're wonderful, but this is our world now. It says there arose such a fierce gale of wind, and the wind and the waves. The word that's being used is for a furious storm or a hurricane. It's not just a single gust or a steadily blowing wind. It is black thunderclouds and furious gusts with steady sheets and floods of rain and lightning and powerful sky that just tips boats over. And now the storm races down the mountain and through the dark. You could still see it by the moon coming at you. Then the waves proceeded. They start coming and hitting. There's yelling. The more hopeless, the more blaming. Come on, get over. Grab the jib, turn it. They're screaming, and everybody knows their position, where they're supposed to be. They're grabbing. They're doing everything they can do humanly possible. The more hopeless, the more blaming. The waves are swamping the boat now. The boat is filling with water. It's up around their calves now. They're trying to turn the boat into the wind to stabilize it. It's nighttime, and the boat is going down. And when it does go down, they will be lost at sea. This ocean is churning. Now the water is up near their knees and it is swamped. And at some point, each of them stop and realize it's over. We've done everything we know how to possibly do. It's over. It is so interesting. Only when the entire boat fills with water and is completely swamped does anyone think, you know, Jesus is on board. Actually on board. In the entire universe, he's here. And someone says, should we wake him? I think now would be a good time. And I love Rembrandt's picture that it shows Jesus kind of waking up, sitting down. He's not ready to do anything yet. And they yell at him. They yell out these words. Do you not care? Help us! We're perishing! Interesting. We ignore him in the storm until we have exhausted our own abilities. Then we accuse him of not having cared for us. This is the exact charge of mine. This is the exact question. This is hit it on the head. It's not a question. They're not asking, can you fix us? Can you solve this? Can you make this boat seaworthy again? They don't think he can. They're just saying, you say you're the Messiah. What are you doing? Don't you care? Hey, this is our lives, and you're acting like, I'll bet you could just do something, but this is us. So this gets very personal for me. All my life, this has been my default position. When I can't make sense of my reality, I feel alone again. Nobody is able or willing to protect me, so I must protect myself, and I hunker down. And I forget that Jesus is even there until I am desperate, and then I accuse him of not having cared for me. I must protect myself. Words like these are the last that I say before I start drowning in my own self-reliance or self-defense. See, the cost in losing hope of God's willingness to protect me is this. Sin, compulsion, addiction, my issues, they don't go away. They don't evaporate. It never gets no longer in the universe. It's just back here, behind a door called faith. And as long as I stay under that protection and I trust, that's what faith is. It's trust. It's a real thing and it makes a real difference. But the cost in losing hope of God's willingness to protect me is this. Whatever he was protecting me from, it's now back, fully on deck, wildly animated. And I churn these thoughts that you never hear. But when you go long enough, feeling that some things that he should have solved if he was good, forget powerful, just if he was good, he would try to solve, he doesn't solve. After a while, if there isn't somebody around to challenge it who can get inside, if it isn't challenged, I start having these thoughts. He doesn't really know my best. If he knew my best, this would not be happening. He obviously does not really, something's wrong. Something's not getting, he doesn't know my best. He must not be able to feel what I'm going through. If he could feel what I'm going through, he wouldn't allow it. He doesn't understand what this is doing to me. I know he's God, I know he can see everything, but he can't possibly understand what this is doing to me because he has all power. He has the power to make it stop. He could override. I know he could. He promised me that I would be victorious. Huh. He must not be totally, maybe he's in control of the world, but not my world. He seems almost indifferent to what I'm going through. He goes furthest away, it seems like, when I need him most visible. And apparently, he is willing to leave me behind the parade. He either forgets about me or he's unable to help me. And I have thought all those. I've believed all those at one time or another. I'm sorry to say that to you, but I have, and I believe that some of you have also. Let me ask you a question. Does Jesus know this storm is going to happen before they go out in the boat? How many of you think he knew? Yeah. Yeah, he absolutely. Come on, boys, let's go to the other side of the lake. What I'm not mentioning, you're never going to get on a boat again. Wow. Now, there's a lot of thinking, a lot of theology that I couldn't fit in this message. I will preach it to you at my home. I have pages and pages of notes. I'm really happy to do that, but I don't have time this morning. So let me just fill all that theology into this one statement. Jesus doesn't create calamities to teach you a lesson. Oh, having a little bit too much fun there, are we? How would you like a little storm? A little storm where I break the jib mast. There is no jib mast, I'm sure, but it's all I got. Jesus doesn't create calamities to teach a lesson. He employs what already exists, what already is going to happen, to mature us into who we had hoped we were and might become. So interesting. Jesus knew there was going to be a storm that night. Jesus was really tired and actually did fall deep asleep. Jesus knew that they would have a safer, less eventful evening staying back in Capernaum. And Jesus knew that they needed to experience, though, events that they couldn't solve themselves to learn to trust his ferocious protection, power, love, and goodness. Before they went out, Jesus knew that they would accuse him of not caring about them. And Jesus knew that he would not leave or abandon them. He knew no matter what happened, he was not going to leave them. They didn't know it, but he knew that he would never leave them or forsake them. And no matter where I am or what I'm doing, where you are or what you're doing, before it happens, Jesus has resolved, I will not let them alone. I will not leave them. I will not abandon them. And Jesus, the wind and the rain, they had rehearsed the scene already. So here we are. It's near deafening. It's so loud, thunder crashing to where it just terrifies you. It overwhelms you. Sheets of rain, howling, screaming wind, shouting, terrified. Terrified men. And the moon now is hidden by engulfing clouds. No one could see anything. There's only blackness with flashes of lightning for a moment. And now all those men who had been doing their jobs, trying everything they could to save the ship, they are all around Jesus. They have all decided if there is any hope for them at all, it would be in this one that they can barely see through this storm. And some of them around his feet. And now it's time. Jesus says, now you're ready. And you were not ready a moment before. And he stands up, I imagine, and raises his hands. He doesn't have to do anything. He could just think it, and the wind would stop. But for effect, for them, Charlton Heston will be doing this one day. Hush, be still! Three words. Quiet. Like a faucet turning off, nature goes limp. The rain stops, the wind stops, the clouds dissipate, the waves go flat. Men are strewn all over the deck, hanging onto masts and holding onto his feet. The only sounds are the whimpering and panting of 12 men and the dripping of water from sails. The only one standing is Jesus. He's silhouetted by the moon behind him. He says nothing for a while. And then he says, I know you're afraid. You still don't believe it, do you? You still don't have faith. You still don't know who I am. You still don't know who I am. I know, it's okay. I'm not mad at you. I'm just telling you what we both know now. You have acted strong for so long now. You've acted like you were heroic. Even today, you tried to pretend that you were the strong ones and you would prove it to me by what you did at sea. I know, you have acted strong for so long, but you are afraid, all of you, each of you, of so many things. You are afraid because you've not yet, until this moment, feared me. I love verse 41. It says, now, they were afraid, and now, literally, they became very much afraid. We were afraid before when we thought we were just going to die. Don't get me wrong, that was scary. But this is scarier. I've never experienced anything in my life as terrifying as what I just saw, although it was the very thing I wanted the most of all. They became very much afraid. Since I started preaching here, I've always called that fear awe, reverential awe, or intense holy awe, because I was afraid that we would see Jesus wrong, that we would be afraid of him, that we'd be scared of him. So I called it awe, and it can be translated awe, but most of the translators don't translate it awe. In fact, they call it sometimes horribly, wickedly terrified, freaked out, devastated. And they know the word awe. They have the ability to use the word awe. God does not want you to feel threatened around him, ever. God does not want you to feel unsafe around him. God does not want you to be falsely religious around him. He doesn't want you to be cautious to approach him. He doesn't want you to cover up yourself around him. He doesn't want you to idealize yourself around him. He doesn't want you to pretend in fear of his response. What he wants is you to trust him. That he knows your life, that he loves you, that he makes no mistakes regarding you, and that he cares. He's not playing you. That's what he wants. And sometimes he says, you haven't seen me yet. You haven't seen me clearly, and so you're still afraid. For you or me or any of us to be truly safe in his love, you must first be undone at how small you have made him and experience him in his endless strength and power and glory. Keep that up there for a second. For us to be truly safe in his love, you must first be undone somewhere along the way at how small you have made him and experience him instead in his endless strength and power and glory. So if we're going to call it fear, then let's talk about two kinds of fears so that we never have to confuse this again. There is a fear that makes me run away. And there's a fear that compels me to run toward. There is a fear that immobilizes me. And there's a fear that protects me. There is a fear that causes me to hide. And there is a fear which lets me reveal all that I have hidden. There is a fear that causes me to live very small. And there's a fear that frees me to risk everything. There's a fear that makes me cowardly. And there is a fear that reveals me as brave. There is a manipulative religious fear that terrifies me of Jesus. And there is a fear that ends my fears and causes me to never want to be anywhere but where he is. So the only thing that can take away my fears is to experience the fear of the one who is greater than all my fears. I love it. I love it the way Jesus says it over in Matthew. He says, 10:28, do not fear those who can kill the body but are unable to kill the soul. But rather, fear him who is able to destroy both the soul and the body in hell. And then he looks at them and says, look, are not two sparrows sold for a cent, and yet not one of them will fall to the ground apart from your Father? But the very hairs of your head are all numbered. So do not fear. No longer do you have to fear. You're with me. You have seen what I can do. You know who I am. You have been undone by it. Oh, you are so much more valuable than many, many sparrows. I got you. You'll never have to be afraid again after you've believed who I am. I love in Ephesians, Paul doesn't know what else to do. He says, I guess I'm going to pray this, but I can't make this experience happen for you. So the only thing he knows how to do is to pray this prayer for. It's the prayer that I prayed in bed with Caleb and Amy and Carly. I'll pray it with my grandkids as they grow up because it's all I know how to do. He says, I pray that the eyes of your heart would be enlightened. They would light up so that you will know what the... So you'll know what the hope of his calling is and what the riches of his glory, of his inheritance are in the saints. And you'll know the surpassing greatness of his power towards us who believe. You just pray that and just say, God, please do that. Please do this amongst the people I love. Please let it happen for me because I can't manipulate it. I can't go out and say, I see you as great and strong and powerful. I just can't drum it up. Okay, turn down the lights, if you will, and bring up that slide again. I have up until now not put myself in the story because it just felt gratuitous. It felt like it slowed down the story, but I want to put myself in the story now because I got put in the story this week. There's one person we haven't talked about. That guy. Look at him. He's put a blanket around himself. He's not looking at Jesus. He's not even looking at the storm anymore. He's just looking down. It's over. He has put a blanket on himself and is resigned to die. I give up. I don't care. So this guy was me a little while ago when I was stronger. That's me right now. And for just a moment, because I've become afraid. So afraid. So afraid of so many things because I forgot. I forgot who Jesus was. I know who he is. I know his saving power. I've known his power in my life, but when you take over, you minimize the wonder of God because you've taken over. How can you worship when you're the one doing everything? When you think you're causing all the effect, what am I worshiping? And you forget, and I become very afraid because I realize all the things that can go wrong in my world and how unable I am to take care of them. And I'm still stuck with all those lies. So for a moment, or many moments, Jesus is willing to let me be very much afraid, to be terrified again, so I can no longer be afraid of man, of life, of loss, of brokenness, of pain. Most weeks I tell you, I don't even know if I'm always telling the truth. I try to tell you the success stories of me believing this passage that I'm going through or experiencing that. But this one, dang it, this one, I have fought for a long, long time. And I'm pretty able to ride them out. So what you don't know about me, although I'm preaching, although I'm still doing stuff and I can still articulate something, I've got a blanket around me and I've seated and I'm turned around and my head's down and I'm waiting for it to wrap up. So I can be that man in the blanket, just waiting for it to be over. Not all the time. Please, not all the time. I love my kids. I love my children. I love this place. I love getting what I get to do, but I know that man more than anybody on the boat. See, like Paul, I can pray this for you and for me in Ephesians, but as Bill Thrall has said, everything in my life, I will either learn by faith or by experience. And this one, I'm for so far, I appear to be learning it by experience. For some of us, it will take that. And I will say to us, so what's that sound in the distance? Do you hear it rumbling? Yeah, dang it. Here it comes. Cresting over Mount Hermon. And it's the last I will think about Jesus for a while because I know how to do this and I will get to work on all the things that I can do and all the things that I think I can control, and I will manipulate my circumstances, and I will whine, and I will complain, and I will yell, and I will be frustrated at other people, and I will talk about them, and I will get in arguments, and we will da 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 da. We'll do all that stuff until I finally can't do anything more, and I am up to my knees in water, and I'm thrashed from a piece of wood that came flying at me, and I am absolutely undone, and I remember Jesus. And I crawl over to his presence, and I have nothing to say, and he knows everything. He's not wanting me to beg. He's not doing any of that. But for the first time in a long time, I realize, help, if you don't care about us, if you don't care about me, I will perish. And he says, all right, that's all I was waiting for. And he says, hush, be still. And I'm still John Lynch, and I still have my stuff, but the water is still. And I am safe. I am safe in love that I have forgotten. Knowing that the storm would happen, Jesus could have kept them all back in Galilee that evening. And the next morning, they would have awakened the same. In love with a wonderful Messiah, but not knowing him enough to trust him in danger and tragedy, glued to self-dependent, self-serving strategies, still stuck in their secret fears, facing the day with little more power or protection than their own. And they would have missed getting to stand knee-deep in water with mouths wide open, at first more frightened by this God than by any storm on any sea, and then freed in innocent love, fully knowing they were totally safe in the protection of the one who calms the storms. God, I take this communion every week. And I have forgotten how invincibly strong and courageous you were on my behalf when I didn't even know you were fighting for me. All that you accomplished on that cross for me so I would not have to be alone. You have turned evil on its head. You do whatever you want. No one can thwart you. And the beauty is, what I did not count on is that you love me beyond everything else.